Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good morning, good evening, good night, NBN Entrepreneurship and Leadership.
Personally, I'm fascinated by the story.
Trust is an underrated weapon in the business landscape.
I'm a really, really strong believer in learning by doing.
What's the definition of success?
You're trying to come up with an answer to the question. But go ahead, Richard.
You could be right, but you're wrong.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, whatever time of the day or night it is. Entrepreneurship and Leadership Channel listeners on the NBN. Today, I'm with my co-host, Kimon Pontakidis, and our guest, Soren Stammer, who's the CEO and co-founder of Core Media, who I had the privilege of meeting at the TED conference back in April 2022. Soren, I could try to introduce you based on reading your LinkedIn profile, but I think it's much better to flip it back to you and say, please just introduce yourselves to our listeners in a minute or so, explaining who you are and what you do.
Richard, thank you. Thanks for having me, actually. It was great to meet you at TED. I'm an entrepreneur. I founded a company as a student 26 years ago and built that up. It was at the university with two of my computer science professors. So I built the company as a CEO and co-founder for the first 13 years. Then, interestingly, I had promised myself to take a year off, travel around the world, and see what I want to do next, if I want to go back. I did that actually a little later than 1 year later than planned, and ended up in the Silicon Valley for 6.5 years. And then actually did something interesting. I went back to my company and took over the CEO role again for the second stint. And that's what I do now. So I'm the CEO of Core Media, a software company providing content management and experience management for global brands. So quite a few of the brands that we know use our technology to create beautiful experiences on all the different touch points on the mobile phones, online stores and the like.
And in terms of numbers, can you give a sense of the scale of the business? Are you in the billions, the hundreds of millions, the tens of millions? I think I asked you that question at TED and you hesitated for a moment. You said, well, I'm going to tell you. Don't share anything you don't want to share. But I think it's really helpful for our listeners to get a sense of what those numbers might be.
Yeah, so we are not in the billions, not in the hundreds of millions. We are on track. We are between 20 and 30 million and growing nicely, like 20% a year. So we aim to basically get to 50 million in the near future.
That's great. Well, thank you. And in terms of your story, we're really interested in what leads people to being entrepreneurs. So the fact you founded your company when you were a student is some of our guests have done that, but not all of them. Did you know even before you went to university that you were going to be an entrepreneur? Was it obvious to you, like from as long as you can remember, that you had to have your own business, or was it a kind of
that you stumbled into? I thought about that, right? And I think it has actually been my upbringing. I grew up on a farm, on a family farm, with three siblings. My grandparents were there, and the family farm is in the hands of the family since I think 1400 something, like for a long, long time, right? Basically, and when I was 8, I think I wanted to be a farmer. I want to take over that farm. But then when I was 10 or something, I realized I have an older brother and he basically has the first rights of refusal.
That was going to be my first question, whether you were the oldest son.
No, I wasn't, right? And then in Europe, you have basically different rules. You had actually areas in Germany where they split up the farm. They basically made us make smaller farms for the kids. And, you know, I think in Bavaria, that was the case. So they have smaller and smaller pieces. Then they have areas where the youngest son got the farm. Also interesting. And then most areas where the oldest. Over the years, they changed it. Now it's the oldest child. But you also have to learn farming to basically have the rights to get the farm. And so I realized at that point in time, well, my brother wants to do this, and I'm also lazy. So just getting up in the morning and milking the cows at 7:30 or at 5:30 is not my you know, strongest kind of a desire. So I realized, yeah, I have to build my own thing. And I liked computers at that point in time, and I was kind of like looking at, I liked physics. So I thought about studying and went to this, you know, there's really like a office in Germany where you can go to get advice on your kind of like potential studies or whatever you want to do. And they told me, okay, you're good at math and science. So, you know, how about become a mathematician? Then you can calculate the death tables for insurance companies. And so, yeah, maybe not. Oh. I like math, but I don't like
actuary.
That. So then I was into physics. I liked physics, especially kind of like theoretical physics. I went to actually DAISY, which is a lab here in Hamburg with a particle accelerator. And for some reason, I kind of said, well, no, maybe that's also not it. And I looked at computer science. However, at the end, I said, well, I will study business administration and computer science as a mix, because I really had the desire to build my own business. And that was early on the case. I think when I was 17, 18, I realized that. I also basically financed my studies being computer scientist. I worked as a freelancer. I programmed, I you know, solved IT problems, and I loved computers. So anyway, that was kind of like my first stint.
So you had a little, because that's what sort of what we're looking. You had a little bit of a, let's say, consulting, call it a consulting, like you were freelancing, you were looking for jobs. Then was there any other kind of entrepreneurial thing? Even like, did you sell anything? Did you take the farm goods to the market and sell them yourself and make an ad? Was there any?
No, basically more like being part of the family business is the other part, right? Because like when you have this like old farm thing, my mother and my father, they worked together on the farm. My grandpa was there, my brother at some point. So you have this big table in the morning and the like lunch and in the evening. And you sit there and basically you're always talking about business. It's kind of like, you know, and you learn quite a few lessons, I think, that are important as an entrepreneur. For example, you know, as a farmer, you know, well, like first you have to seed something and you have to basically wait. You have to have patience because it's not ready the next day. So it takes time. Yeah. Second thing is also my father was really good at that. So you want to harvest something and you have a rain shower. Well, you have to live with that. It doesn't make anything better when you now scream and throw a fit. You just have to basically roll with it. And so, yeah, that's the new reality. We adjust. So the agility of being a farmer is much bigger than people give credit. So you have to roll with what nature gives you. And quite a few of these things I learned at the farm.
I think that's really valuable. Yeah. And actually, we've had, Richard, a couple farmers. It's a funny that there is a common thread I've seen, and I never would have expected with farming and business, actually. But it makes a lot of sense, actually. And I like what you said about the agility and rolling with the punches as things happen, because you have to do that. That's business. Yeah. I mean, business.
Right? It's like, you know, it's basic core value added, isn't it? I mean, you've got the miracle of the hen. It eats sort of eats crap and produces eggs every day. And then you can or an egg every day, and then you can eat it at the end. And it's kind of marvelous how nature creates value. Obviously, there's a lot of fine tuning.
Yeah.
It's really interesting, and you've said it more explicitly than our other guests. But a lot of the other two farmers, as a farmer's daughter and a farmer's son, very recently were talking about the culture of hard work and sort of the ethic. And presumably, your parents worked pretty hard.
Exactly. And it also, it was fun, right? I enjoyed it. I enjoyed working the farm. I enjoyed actually, for example, that they gave me the freedom to drive this tractor when I was 14 for a whole day on this gigantic machine or the combine. Right? I really kind of like had fun doing that. And they taught me early on, like, hey, we trust you handling, you know, expensive, dangerous things. We teach you, mm-hmm. but also we trust you. And it really kind of like helped me to say, I didn't ask myself, oh, am I allowed to be an entrepreneur with 23? I was just doing it. And I didn't basically enter the room of potential clients questioning that. It was very obvious. No, I do this and it's no question. And the other thing, I think collaboration, right? It's like, it's a family business. So everyone has to help. And some of these values that you have there, I used also to start the company. There's some drawbacks to that because the company is not a family at the end. So they come to that conclusion at some point in time as well. But I think there is some parts of, you know, how you treat people that is something you can take away from, you know, working as a family, appreciating people. And also everyone has to chip in and, you know, solve conflicts and talk about stuff.
Well, I would actually add the trust thing as well. I think that if you were granted trust and then you can trust, that's a major anti-bottleneck for the entrepreneur, because it frees you up if you're going to be able to trust people, basically.
And you get what you expect, right? If you expect kind of like something, you can trust people, they notice and they do a lot to fulfill that trust. If you don't trust them, they'd also notice and will fulfill that expectation too. Right?
Yeah, it's a self-fueling process. And coming, when you were doing your computer consulting or programming work as a teenager, do you remember how you got your first clients? Like, or did you hear of someone else getting well-paid work as a computer consultant? Because quite often those first times someone pays you to do something, you know, it's obviously selling labor and advice isn't quite the same as entrepreneurship as we define it, but it's an entrepreneurial step to figure out finding a client. Yeah. So do you remember your first ever client for consulting services when someone paid you for doing programming?
Yeah. So if we should take out the stuff you do as a child, right? Basically working I actually work at the bank to carry around their kind of like papers like in the morning. But when we take that off, the entry was through one of my professors. He gave lectures on statistics and you know, we call it ADV, which is basically like computer science for business people. Like, you know, and so he gave that lecture for the business administration students, and he basically discovered me and made me his assistant. So I basically gave lectures, and he also had this business, this consulting business, and hired me to basically through him work for some other companies. Mm-hmm. So it was really kind of like he was in a way my first client. But then also things like when AOL, for example, you remember those guys, when they came to Europe, they needed some help and I knew some guys at the university. So they sent me there to fix stuff. So in a way, it came through my network. It was a good time, actually. It was kind of like early on, it was partly hardware, was partly basically setting up networks, was partly programming, was hacking finding some solution to some crazy problem. What happened then was that this first professor at the computer science, at the business administration department, introduced me to his friend at the computer science department. And that was life changing because this Professor Schmidt, he ran a computer science department in Hamburg that was extraordinary. So normally when you go to a university, I wasn't that impressed with the research that happened there. But this was different. It was a tight-knit team of students and PhD students who sat together in a room at their Sun workstations, and they're working on the same basic research, like a programming language. And it was before Java came out. It was called Tycoon, typed communicating objects in open environments. And it was actually really trailblazing. It was kind of like a programming language, object-oriented with a built-in type checker and compiler and everything. But it also had persistency as a concept that was built into the language. So everything you touched with the language was persistent. So not just the data and the code, it was even the data, the code in execution, so the threads, the running programs, everything was persistent. So that this means that when you shut off the computer and you restart it, the programs are really right where they were and they are moving further. But even better, you could throw threads into a database and get them out next day. But even better, the best thing we did was 1995. We sent a running program from a Windows machine with Windows open, everything, you could tell the program, hey, please move to the Macintosh next to you. And then the Windows disappeared and the program with all the bindings, all the data, everything moved over to the Mac, and the Windows appeared again in the same state.
Wow.
Had the same program.
That's crazy.
Going from Windows machines to Macs to Linux.
That's crazy.
To Solaris and back. Right. We had migrating threads in 1995. And we were, hey, look, guys, look what's possible, right? This is the future. Like, you know, you send your program to wherever it should go and it comes back and all that. It was amazing technology, amazing research behind it. And we showed it to some companies like SAP, you might have heard of. And they said, yeah, great. We don't need that. So we had then the audacity to say, well, if you don't need it, then we will prove you. We will basically start a company. And
and that is such a good thing. So I just want to jump in there, but you know, the role of rejection when you think you've got something really great and someone says no is can be so motivating. In this is like, I'm going to show these idiots they're wrong, you know, because you knew that it was, well, and I don't want to say SAP, you know, SAP is way more successful than me, and it's a really dumb thing to criticize world leading companies, but sometimes the person who said no is a major driver of motivation, right?
And it was 1990, it was actually the Christmas party 1995, where we get together at a bar and we talked about, hey, well, we should start a company. It was more like a silly idea. And in April next year, we started the company. And actually, we kind of like got the first client was the German press agency. So it's like AP in Germany. And also a funny story, because like there was some contact to the chief of the editorial team. About his, I think, mushroom collection. He's a mushroom collection that he wanted to put it on the internet. And the department that we were at the university, they were the first ones to run web servers. So for the city of Hamburg, for the university. So we basically were very close to CERN and the you know, web, World Wide Web kind of like developments. So we basically were asked about this, if we could help. Before I could even go there to talk to them, they realized, this internet thing is bigger, so we should potentially do something here and have a multimedia news service. And so the conversation I had with them is like, yeah, let's, in the next few months, build a multimedia news service, refactoring the data that they send out anyway, the images and the real-time news, and create a multimedia service from it, sending over satellite to different boxes and machines that we send somewhere, so that the different newspapers in Germany could integrate it into their websites and in their own designs and stuff. So we built this service, and we made the stupid mistake to have the launch date being at the end of the year, like New Year's Eve, which is a shitty deadline for any project. So I never made that mistake again. So, but we launched it and it became a success, actually.
The core technology that you built, that you proposed to SAP, is there a connection then with that? And then you met the guys, you went to the bar, you said, look, we're getting rejected. Yeah. These guys don't know what they're talking about. We can do this. But then, and then you get managed to get this German AP or whatever the press agency. What is there a connection between the
connection
tech
was,
that you did, or did you actually then build something else for them? I'm trying to catch that.
So the connection was basically with that programming language and the frameworks that we had. We were pretty fast at forcing building, platforms for data gathering, for transformation of data, like parsers to find the meaning in data and structures, and build a website or web services with that. So it was a nice framework to do these things before you had other things to do that. So we used kind of the technology to now just, build this, solve this problem, which was certainly solvable in any other technology as well. But we knew our tool, we were good with it, we were fast.
Right.
So it was just a good way of starting this problem. And the second customer was the Axel Springer, the biggest European publisher. They had a different problem. They, had all these ads, all these kind of like, how they called the classified ads, cars and apartments and the like. And they wanted to put them online, but as with DPA, with the German press agency, it was everything on some old host system. So it was hard to get the data out of this system and then do something with it. And we did there, actually, we built this system that analyzed the data and found out all the, what is the phone number? What is an, you know, is a BMW, is a car, okay, the 316, we knew kind of like it's a model. We knew all the zip codes. We knew all the descriptions of different things. We knew what is close to the university. So basically we had a system to take that unstructured data and turn it into a nice database to research, like find your kind of your ads. And we did that for them and it was a nice business. But our proposal was, guys, you know, you get the data on the Thursday. Thursday, everything is done that is printed on Saturday. Why don't you basically create the database, put it out there, but you take away the phone numbers and the, you know, contact information. So, and then you tell people, you know what, we can even send you an email when your favorite thing is there, when your Ferrari below 10,000 euros is available, then
wow, Thursday, that was cutting edge at that time.
Right. That was all in there. But then we told them, guys, and then, you know, what do you, you make them pay. You basically, when people want to have access to that data on Thursday, you pay 20 Deutschmark. And then on Friday, 10. And on Saturday afternoon, it's free because then the newspaper is done. And they said, yeah, nice idea. You know what? We just wait until Saturday afternoon when the newspaper is sold. And so I'll be like, no. So when you think about it, it was 1996, and we already had a solution for them to really start making people pay. I was looking for an apartment in Hamburg, and certainly if you get a head start of 2 days, you would pay exactly for that phone number a lot, actually. And you know, when you think back, they lost that market, right? So later on, they didn't do that, and they had fun for a while. But then, you know, all these other people came building just pure play web services and having that there. And so they basically lost that. They could have done something very different. But, you know, as usual, when you have a big business that is highly profitable, you know, you don't look at the future that much. You look at protecting the stuff that you have. Mm. So what happened then was interesting. We kind of like learned a lot from these two companies. But we also realized Java came out, Java 0.7, I think. And we said, okay, now we have like 20 something students and people here working on the base technology and basically doing a bootstrap of our own language to make it even better. And then we have three people working on customer projects to pay the bill. So we were profitable, but it was obvious to us that, you know, we will not win against Sun with Java.
Yeah.
So after a year, we killed our child. We killed our
That's smart. Language.
But it was interesting, right? Because like the founding of the company was to prove that this is working. And we were not sure what happens when we say, hey, it's dead now. We basically make it open source and we move on. But within 2 weeks, nobody, you know, was missing anything. We had learned a lot about multimedia, a lot about content, a lot about, you know, how you have to solve that problem correctly. And I'm not kind of like managing HTML pages, but, you know, really deeply content as an asset. And we used that knowledge to build a new product. And that's what we basically rely on today still. So the core ideas that we learned there are still true, are still driving our business.
That's a lesson that I've learned as well. I mean, if you find yourself spending a lot of resources on something, like when you said it, I knew where you were going because you said you had a couple of people working on client projects and the rest of the team working on this back-end thing that you can replace. It's like, why build, you know, my business partner says, why build Excel? If Excel exists, why build Excel? Use Excel and use the resources to build, you know, and that's basically what you did. And look, you made that decision and then you built the core technology that you said that you're basically still running on today, or that's the key piece of your business, which is just
the
a lot of people,
really,
believe it or not,
like,
don't do that.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't do it. They can't kill the child. They can't.
You love your stuff too much, right? You basically are.
Stuck. Exactly.
It was a good experience because like it also at that point in time, there was so much more, right? The company and the cohesion and the way we work together. We had amazing talent because of this connection to the university. We always basically got the greatest kind of like engineers early on, had that as a working student, and then they basically directly moved over to the company. So we really had this kind of like amazing talent pool and amazing projects, right? Basically at that point in time, you know, internet was pretty new still, but everyone needed it. So we won amazing projects. And at some point in time, we won the Winter Olympics in Vancouver. So that, like, for two weeks, it was the biggest site in the world to you know, with a lot of traffic because everyone wanted to see the scores and stuff. So it was really kind of like some fun things that we did over the year that kept people together. But yeah, one thing that happened also was we did that as a bootstrap. We didn't put much money in. So it was really financed by the four founders. And I was a student, so I didn't have that much money. So it was really, you know, little money, a bank loan, and that's it. So we kind of like were so naive. We bought at the beginning, because we had this ambition to build a big company, we bought USM Haller tables. You might use them as it's a premium brand for tables. Right? When you go to a dentist, an expensive dentist, they have that kind of stuff. And we bought workstations from Sun. You know, well, we got a good deal there because of the connection. But we really kind of like spent a lot of money on stuff you would not really spend.
So you're sharing something super important. A lot of entrepreneurs, yes, like, they become wise over time, but you were spending money on stuff that clients didn't care about at all because you wanted to do with ego and status, I guess. You wanted to feel like
cool company. Yeah, it was part of the you know, the interest of one of the founders was, no, we don't want to be a small thing. We want to do something big, and therefore let's. The funny part is now we are just moving offices and we don't need these tables anymore. But actually, we get the money back for these first tables. They are so valuable 20 years later. So they are really very long term. They are a good investment. Short term, you're short on cash. It's a stupid thing to do that.
Yeah. Richard, please. No, because it reminded me of a story. Richard and I had a business together, and the CEO wanted to buy. Didn't he buy a big sign, like a huge, like we were like, why, like gigantic, like on the top of a building, like it was going to be the biggest company in the world. And it was expensive. And I think when the thing finally, it didn't collapse completely, but when we moved or something like that, I think we said, why don't we give him the sign and take it home or something like that? Because this has been an example of this, like spending money in the not optimal.
This is a perfect segue into your sort of personal motivation. So just listening to you, it's clear now that, you know, the what you were doing for clients, the exciting technical side of things, you know, even you sort of light up as you talk about it. And did your motivate, and but on the other hand, there was this ego stuff of like, we want to be big, or some of your partners want us to be big. Can you like reflect on how your motivations evolved over time? Because you've had these different chapters, and we don't have to go through your life totally chronologically, but on the motivation, you ran it for quite a while, you knew you wanted to do that. And how far was it money? How far was it significance? And did that evolve as you started becoming, let's say, not super rich, but like comfortable? Did your motivations change about what was important to you?
Yeah. So when I started the company, it was kind of like this proof point, but hey, we have great technology, great people, like let's just do it. But I was young. I realized I could go now to, you know, one of the big consultancy companies. And they interviewed me and they said, no, that's not what I want. Like, now I'm really free and I can do whatever. So why would I waste my kind of like great years? On the other hand, you are naive, right? You have no clue. You have no experience. So that can, in one way, be a benefit. And the benefit was, if you are young and naive, you have one thing for you. And that is, you have to learn fast. And you don't have to unlearn things, because some of the truth of the past are potentially not true anymore. And that was, I think, deeply instilled in this company. Being a spin-off of the university, learning and growing and reflecting and finding better abstractions was always part of the DNA of the company. And I enjoy that. I enjoy learning. I enjoy kind of like exploring new things. I enjoy also enabling others to learn. So it's a big part of my motivation is building a team and an organization that is able to grow and evolve and get better, and also helping others in that organization or that we work with to grow as well. So that's, I think, also long-term a very good thing, because it helps you to survive. So if you have an organization that is able to learn faster than others, it also is something that has a higher likelihood of being around when things are changing quickly. And we had that quite a few times, right? Like 2000 was crazy, and then quite a few times afterwards as well, where you had suddenly big shifts in society. Today, you make good money with that. In our industry, right, everyone basically really gets a good salary, and you're able to do that. And growing a business also helps me to have like financial independence. It's it's not unimportant. I think it was very important when I started, when I went to university. I had a conversation. Someone remembered the first day at the university, a friend of mine, and said, when I was asked, okay, why did you do this? I said, I want to be rich and independent or something. So I really had this idea of financial independence as something that was important to me. Today I have achieved a lot of that, right? So in a way, now it's really kind of like still, you know, what can we do to make the place a better place to work? For example, like we don't believe in this making people the same. We much more see that, you know, you have talents and ideally you have an organization then that can organize around the talents and make the talents grow, enable them to basically even change and use different roles. So that's a different organization than what you might find in some of the old school setups where you strict part of the description of a role and you have to fulfill this and everything else is out of bounds here. So we do the opposite. We explored early on, I think in 2003, 2004, 2005, we explored ways to get rid of hierarchies. So now you would call it like agile leadership. We did that early on without kind of that background, just from our observation that, you know, we're getting more stiff. The world is getting more networked and faster. So how can we change that? How can we benefit from more network thinking than hierarchy thinking? So in a way, this exploring better ways and learning is something that is amazing. And the other thing,
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Now, I'm just wondering, when you're talking about the talent, do you have, because that's something that I've had like issues with in running businesses, is because I actually strongly believe that everybody isn't equal. And this, and that's where, and avoiding the situation. But, and I wonder if you did that. One thing is obviously giving people the freedom without hierarchy to do stuff. But the other thing that's interesting is money, because I always felt strongly that I'm going to pay the people, like everybody isn't, it's not, it can't be flat. And it doesn't matter what your job title is. It matters what value you're generating. And we're going to keep paying more and more to the people that are generating the most value. Did you have that reflection? Because that's always, and I think coming from the university, I don't know whether this is true or not, but if that's in your DNA, that there would be a level of, oh, we must be equal. And like, because that's a very market concept, that two people are in the same position and one is making double the other. Is that even like a possibility, or is that something that you didn't go there?
It's over the years.
Or maybe you can't talk about it.
Over the years, we got more of that. But from our perspective, a lot of the employees, the technical employees, for example, told us, for example, at some point in time, we gave them stock options. So, hey, you know, there's nothing you have to do. Here's some shares that basically gets you money if we have an exit at some point. Yeah. There were employees, there was one I remember, he told me, no, I don't want those. I said, no, hey, there's no drawback here. It's just an upside. It's just basically, you know, your ticket to get some. He said, there isn't downside. And the downside for him is if he has those, he has to worry about them. They can go up and down, and that will be stress for him. And he doesn't want that stress. He refused to take the stock options. And so there is part of the group who want much more stability and, you know, predictability and fairness than maximizing their income. We have quite a few of those actually. But then the other dimension where it's people say, hey, I basically do great things and I want to also be appreciated for that. So it's not always the same that people would do it through money. Actually, we have different groups in the organization. For some, the money part is not the key. They expect other recognition. But yeah, it is the topic. Actually, there I read about this company in Brazil. They went so far to say not just the hierarchy is something that is voted for. You select your leaders, even the salary. And the idea there is everyone can set their own salary, and the team decides if you are affordable for that salary or not. So then basically, you say I need the 500,000, and they say, oh yeah, you are worth 500,000, but we can't afford you. Please, move on.
Yes.
And that's maybe not a bad thing to do. We haven't gotten that far though. With the salary part, there's still more experimentation to be done. I would say.
I think the book's called Maverick. I can't remember who wrote it, but I read that book about 25 years ago. I thought, how the hell did they run that company? Because it's easier to send a podcast. It's another thing to implement something like that.
But I've been always fascinated with the concept of just publicly, and I've never, I floated it, and of course everybody thought I was crazy. But I've always been fascinated with the idea of public. So you can't choose your own salary, but everybody knows what everybody makes, and it's not secret and hidden, because I think that creates a lot of, and just to be clear, Soren, I wasn't saying that the employees were motivated by or trying to get more money. I was trying to say, as a company, we should be proactively rewarding. Not everybody's equal, and some people need to be rewarded. My version of fairness, not everybody gets the same. My version of fairness is the value creators are getting more, more based.
But then you have some questions, right? What happens if someone kind of like for a time period is a big value creator, but then longer term, that part is maybe not a bottleneck anymore and is not as important. You can't really easily push the salary down.
Yeah,
bonuses rather than monthly increases. Exactly. Soren, can you talk a bit about the way, was there anything about managing people? Obviously, managing highly intelligent, talented people is a particular type of challenge. And just talking to you, I get the impression you understand that people are different. You're a good communicator. But were there any things that you learned about managing people? You said you were a bit naive at the start. Were there things that like took you by surprise, that lessons you'd share with other people listening about, you've managed people, you stopped, you started again. What did you get wrong early on, and what advice would you give now to people who have to manage really talented, smart people?
Yeah, it was a great start, right? Basically, you have a small team, everyone fits in one room, and you have breakfast together Monday morning, and everyone knows what's up, and everyone, basically, that's enough management. So we started like that, and high trust, we knew each other from the university and people knew each other. It was a great time. And then you realize with 25 people, at some point that breaks, right? This model of everyone is here, like with light touch, you have more structures that you need and more communication that you need. So we went through that. And then at some point in time, we had the perception that we had to increase more structure. And the only thing I knew was from the university, okay, now you have departments. You need department head. And that was a mistake. So looking back, I think I would have, had a better chance to say, well, no, we organize differently. We organize around pods or around kind of like units of self-sufficiency, but we introduce departments. And departments, I'd say, is not the best idea when you structure an organization. So in a way, that was a mistake, just because we didn't know better. The other thing that I think was interesting was we started out with this feeling of family. And I hired even a lot of friends, like friends of university. Basically, they just ended up in the company. Sometimes I hired them, or some other people hired them, right? Even like close friends. And that was great because we grew, 2000 happened, and we grew with more than 100%, 2001, 130, 2002, we grew like crazy, 150%. So we had a great time, even though the world around us was falling apart. There were so many startups failing and friends kind of like being laid off. And we felt, well, we are different. But I also felt like, this is not good. This kind of like feeling of we are invincible is not a good feeling, because it will hit us at some point in time. And, but yeah, we basically, it hit us in 2003. So we came from 3 years, like 120, 100, 150% growth rate. And we made the budget for 2003 and said, Well, let's plan with something like 100, like it's more like conservative, like the low point of the last 3 years. And we had a hiring plan and we had big clients. We had the Deutsche Telekom, Vodafone, we had basically big projects. And then what happened was at the beginning of the year, Vodafone and Telekom both decided, oh, we overspent for the for the 3G licenses. They spent 100 billion in Germany, the operators. And they said, we want to cut costs. I think the Telekom was like 16 billion in 16 months. So what happened was our biggest projects were suddenly on hold and not happening. And we were coming like this and we suddenly went down like significantly and we had to find a way through that. So what happened then was all the wrong things, right? We needed to lay off some people. And we try to minimize that. We try to basically lay off as few as possible, but I had to lay off some of my friends and it was painful. Some of the friendships, you know, even though everyone knew why and that it was the right thing to do, it was hard for those friendships. Some survived, fortunately, but we also made the mistake that we didn't, you know, lay off more than we really, really needed in that moment. So some investors told us, hey guys, you know, lay off twice as many as you need because then you're good. You're done with that, and you basically. And we didn't. So what happened was a few months later, we had to do another round of layoffs.
And that's the worst. Then you create. Oh, it's man, not
the,
safe here.
The first one was bad, right? The first one was okay. We're not invincible, and it sucked. But the second one is then okay. So how many more of these do we have? And it's my job saving.
Exactly.
Basically, it's like pulling the rug under the feet. Nobody is suddenly safe. Yeah. Feels safe anymore.
It kills. It kills. It's a killer. It takes years to rebuild it. I know exactly. I did the same thing. I know exactly. You have to rebuild it. It's really, really. Yeah. It takes time.
You know, when you're successful, things are easy. People follow you, and you can change direction quickly. When things are like that, falling apart, and you are missing your, you know, you're not fulfilling your statements from last week. Suddenly people don't trust anything you say. So it's harder to then move in the right direction. At the end of the year, we grew with 60%. So we still grew, but it was a really tough year to get through that. We survived it and it made us at the end stronger. We also kind of like had to reflect on this family idea because in a family, you don't lay off people, right? Here you had to lay off people I think it's honest also to tell people, well, we enjoy being together. We work together. And we even have a lot of people coming back later on for the second stint. But we're not really a family, right? It's not the same as a family because we can't guarantee that we can always hire.
Right.
The thing that went well, though, was 2 years earlier. So we did the first financing round in April 2000. It was perfect. It was, you know, the Nasdaq and every stock market was close to peak. I think it peaked in March. April was still feeling good. People expected it to go through. So we signed a deal with an investor. It was 30 times revenue of the next fiscal year. No strings attached. It was just our projection times 30. And they got 10% of the shares and we got the money. They didn't get any liquidation preferences, anything. So there was nothing like that. It was just one rule. As long as they have 7.5%, they have one chair at the board in the board on the board. Right? So that was it. Like one position on the board.
How much did they? What kind of a stake did they take?
It was 10%. They got 10% was the percentage of the.
So just doing the math, possibly for like 30 or 40 million euros or something like that, right? I'm reverse engineering on the numbers. So that's a lot.
Yeah, you're good. So there was kind of like, we said we expected now due diligence and the negotiation of the contract, and they didn't. They just basically never came up with the contract. We said, okay, then fine. We go to the notary and we sign this and it's all good. So we were a little greedy though. Like we expected a year later to be much bigger and get much more money for less shares. And so the second round was scheduled for September 2001. And you might remember that was not a good time to get money out.
No, it was 9/11. It was
9/11. But even before 9/11, it was kind of like all the startups were dying. Like banks shut down their financing.
Yeah, after .com. It was .com and 9/11, yeah.
And then 9/11, we were negotiating at 9/11. And it was kind of like, fortunately, we had this nice growth rate and we closed the deal in October 2001. And we survived that. But in between, we had this really tough time because suddenly our bank, you know, we had a loan with them, at least a guaranteed line that we paid for, and we wanted to use it. They said, actually, you don't have that line. And we like, man, like, you should be on our side. You are our bank. We, you made us pay for this line that we have the availability to use it. And now we want to use it. You tell us we don't have it. That's close to fraud. Right? And you sell me something that is not really there. Like, So that was really frustrating. And through that process with the, we needed cash, we needed the financing. We communicated very openly with our team, because as you mentioned earlier, they are brilliant people. They are smart. They don't, you don't fool those people. They are amazing employees and they are amazing people. So it's not that you basically really would even get away with fooling them, but even the culture would not allow that. So we were very open and transparent. However, there is this thing that you have to think about as a leader. You can, you know, like share too much with people that say, hey, I can't handle this. So while it's my job to solve some problems, there were also people who said, hey, you know, I trust you. I don't really want to have that on my plate. I don't want to be concerned about all these things. So as a leader, you have to be, you know, able to, you know, handle some of that and keep some stuff away from everybody so that not everybody has to be concerned about. But we were very transparent about the numbers and are still are today, up to today. And I think it helps. It helps to kind of like have people trust you to communicate the right things when things are good, but also communicate straight when things are not as good. So that helped us also, I think, through the second phase there, through the layoffs and the double layoff, that people really, you know, felt some trust into our transparency, that we don't, not fooling them, that we made mistakes, okay? But it's not that we basically fooled them.
And you take responsibility. I don't know. It just, this all reminds me of my experience as well. I also just directly took responsibility. I said, it's my fault. I made bad decisions. Like, you know, I could have done a different decision. I made the decision like this.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I did some things right in the past. I made this one wrong. And this is what I did. This is why it's going to be different.
Owning it.
And
owning
it. Exactly.
Oh, man. That's really a huge difference. Right? Because, like, indeed, you need people to trust you. When you run a company and that trust is not there, how basically get you to for them to basically stay on board or kind of like, you know, trust you to go through a tough time and not jump ship in the first moment, because then you really screwed. So we had that for us. Also in Corona times, for example, a similar thing, like this open communication and the trust and also the thoughtfulness. It makes a difference. So it helped me a lot in my life that I kind of like had that experience at home, talking openly about stuff and doing that at the company as well.
I just want to draw attention, like a lot of people, when they think of being a business person, man or woman, being successful, they've got this vision of like the cool front page of a business magazine. And here, you know, Soren's talking about humans reflecting on, you know, I remember very clearly, you know, a lot of business people reflect on the really nasty stuff. I'm firing your friends. Why do you want to be a business owner? Well, I'm going to have to fire my friends or fire people who I mistakenly hired. And these are tough things. And also the bank pulling the credit line. I mean, you know, obviously there are some good bankers out there, but I don't know a single business person who hasn't had run-ins with their bank, which, you know, it's tough, right? And so, but when you reflect on those sort of like the tough experiences, do you think it changed? I mean, do you feel like you had to become a tougher person? I mean, obviously your childhood wasn't easy, but your parents were sort of solvent. You weren't hungry. It was tough, but you weren't hungry.
Yeah.
But do you feel that like the experience changed you, Soren? Like, are you a different person than you were, you know, when you were a young man, like in either a good way or a bad way? We don't want to sugarcoat it. You know?
Yeah, I hope there's some maturity that comes with the years. But I think this ability to handle pressure I have for a long time. So that was something I came with, right? So basically, I know it from risk taking when I was young. So I kind of like had always a very good sense of risk. So for example, my elder brother, he got a motorbike and basically crashed quite a few bones. I got a motorbike and I avoided that, right? So I find the right balance of you know, where I want to go. And today as well, I noticed with my wife and some other conversations that I'm pretty good at handling pressure, at handling kind of like, also risk. And people reflect that to me. Some people say, okay, they don't know this, but I try to always open up also, like in between in Corona times, there were some tough moments. I think 2001, the first half of the year, they didn't feel good. It was another year of Corona, then the Northern German winter, like vitamin D deficiency. So I didn't feel good at all. And we had some changes in the team. So, and I shared that as well. A friend of mine was dying. And so it's kind of like that part is also something that I shared. But yeah, I think this, over the years, what I did was I worked with a coach. I worked with a group of entrepreneurs where we meet up for 3.5 days. And it's interesting because what it is you meet other people that are also working on their personality, and you work together for 3.5 days. And what you do is you prepare, you execute, and you reflect on the reflection of your person. Like you talk openly about how do the other people perceive you. And while doing that, in a self-organized way. So there's no leader. There's nobody telling you what to do. So the group has to come together and work together and do this 3.5 days program. And it is interesting because it's kind of like holding a mirror up and you see yourself and the reflection of the other people, how they perceive you when you enter the room, when you negotiate with them, yes. When you fight, so everything, right? Like the subconscious. And it helped me a lot to, like an onion, to unpeel the onion and to learn something about myself, like the assumptions that you have that you don't even know about, but that are shaping your behavior.
You have to give us a detail. Was there something that was like annoying or upsetting or surprising that you were convinced you were like this, and in fact there was a big gap between your, or is there anything you can share? You don't have to, it's pretty personal, but it's
Many things. I think the one thing that I was not kind of like speaking clearly when I was not yet convinced of something. So like mumbling when something kind of like try to, not make a clear statement, and that is not helpful. I got that reflected, or it was something also this thing of the balance of, when do I basically go into a conflict and resolve that conflict? And when do I basically let it be for a while and observe it? And then also the intensity. So I, at some point in time, I was reflecting this more like the guy with a huge kind of like sword and getting in there and like, bam, nobody is standing anymore. So I got reflected, for example, I'm close to 2 meters high. So like 6'6", I think. It's just me sitting there is for some people frightening.
The space
that I take with my physical, and nothing I can do about that really, but it's something that I have to understand, right? That has an impact on some. And I also reflected that, I had a group with 3 women, and one woman shared that for her it's stress to be in this group with men in there, and because of the behavior that happened at her company, that she feels threatened by that. And so while I didn't do that, it's interesting for me to know that, oh yeah, that is part of the reality that you kind of like have to work with, right? And basically, a lot of things. Like also when I get to points where I kind of like opened up emotionally and something painful, I felt, wow, I did this thing and it took for ages and I was really vulnerable. And then people said, yeah, it was a few seconds where I could see that you were kind of like touched, but then it was gone. So I said, interesting. So my perception is like, I opened up this big door here.
Yeah, and it was like, a tiny little.
Right. So a lot of things that make you think and that also enabled us to change, one thing that I, looking back, that helped me a lot in life to live with radical changes was, again, the farm thing. Since 1400 something, it's like a tree with big roots. If you know what is really important to yourself, it's very easy for me to change all the rest. So I decided to leave Germany, go to the US, live there, leave my job, and it didn't feel like a big thing. I didn't
feel. Can you briefly touch on that? We're running short of time, but can you just, because I was really interested at the very beginning when you said, because it's a very unusual part of your story that you founded a company, you left, you went to Silicon Valley, you went to like this like really cool whatever upstart place, and probably where there was a lot of exciting people to meet, exciting things to do, and you spent 6 years there, and then you came back and started back into your thing. Can you just briefly touch on that? Because I think
I still miss it.
Yeah.
So it started out with this thing of starting the company early, and it felt like, yep, let's just try it out. But then a few years later, more and more people said, you will do this for forever. And I was, no, I can do something completely different. And I kind of like saw the risk that I end up doing something that I don't enjoy at some point in time, just because I started it. So when I was 27, I think, I told myself when I'm 35, I will take a trip around the world for a year and I do something else. And then I'm free to do whatever I want to do. And I told everybody, my family, my dentist, I even gave an interview about it. I made it very public that this is my plan.
Right, because you wanted to hold yourself accountable.
Exactly. And I never regretted things I did. I regret things I don't do, even though I want them. That's more the pain. And I turned 35. I turned 36 and I hadn't done it. And that was indeed painful. And I felt the urge that I don't want to let me down. I also had some other ideas that I want to work on. I want to start a family and I wanted to live in the US. I never studied abroad. That was one of the things I regretted, that I didn't basically, you know, take the opportunity as a student or something, live a year abroad. I just basically went fast, start a company. And then, so I really moved on at that point in time, handed over the company and moved to Silicon Valley. There we worked on a few startups and then also took over the role of the stay-at-home dad while my wife, after the third child, kind of like was working again. So I was for 2 years was stay-at-home dad. And the fourth child arrived, and then we had the deal that we switched back. And so I really enjoyed that time. It was an interesting reflection. Also, like how much...
And sorry, you were doing that in California? You were doing this stay-at-home dad thing in California?
In California. I live in I actually did things like nonprofit stuff in Brussels, and I did nonprofit stuff in the US. So like the preschool, I was on the board there, and it was amazing. I learned a lot and used some of my skills actually to as a board president there. But it was also interesting for me to see that there is something missing. You know, I very much enjoyed the time with my kids when they were young, and it was an amazing time. We lived in the Presidio, so in San Francisco in the park, and it was kind of fantastic. Right, we went there this summer, and it's just fantastic. But it's also something missing when you kind of like, you know, this idea of building something and building an organization. So I felt like there is a reason why you don't want to be just that. But I was blessed, right? Stay at home dad, you know. People don't even believe you that you do that, but it was an amazing time. What then happened was that, you know, I had a deal with my wife before she started arrived, but also my dad got sick and it felt not good to be so far away. And my company needed me. So in a way I was then like, we were as a family, I think, as agile to say, hey, like an adventure, let's go to Europe. My wife wanted to live in Europe anyway, so she made me kind of. She's American, but she
Your wife was not. Your wife was American. You met her. It wasn't. I met her in the U.S.
I met her at the Web 2.0 summit in 2007 in the Palace Hotel in San Francisco. Yes.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah, kind of funny. Right? No, but she was very. She liked Europe, and she wanted to go to Europe, and so we took it as a big adventure, like to say, well, we don't know how long, but let's go to Europe. Let's go back. And now we are here and, you know, we're a little more settled now with the house and renovations. But yeah, I think this mental agility was something that was important to all of us.
But wait, Soren, what about the trip around the world? Where does that fit into this whole thing? We're 35. You had all these kids. How could you do it? What?
Yeah, I tell you, you know, we had planned this nice trip and we were about to start. And then my wife got pregnant. It was 2009. It was right when I basically moved over there. And we had to replan so that we squeezed the year and half a year. And because the beginning of the end of the pregnancy, there's some, you know. And then we actually took a trip around the world. We sailed a little bit around Bora Bora. Like we did a sailing in there. But yeah, it was fun. It was, I think, you know, even my wife as a pregnant mother then, it was perfect because you don't have to work. You have around the world that some doctors thinking, but you don't have stress, and it was a great time. Yeah. So we did that too. And I want to do it again, actually.
So you've done it all. You did it all. What a story.
We're coming towards the end of our time, sorry, but I have a feeling that other important things about you and like what you believe in and what you've done or are doing that you haven't had time to share, because I have a feeling there might have been stuff we talked about back in April that you're really into about, philosophy or, and like, I think that if there is stuff that's like important that you've got to share, we'd love you to do that, because I know that I've got a mental note that there's something missing that's important.
There was actually a reflection in the TED, right? It started, was the TED before this one? It was 2 years, not right. It must have been 2019, right? The last TED before that. There was an interesting opener. It was kind of like two sides of, the world is going to shit. It's like all these crazy things that are happening and politics. And then there was the Steven Pinker who said, you know what? All the numbers are getting better. So it's like the world is getting better. What is wrong? Like, and there was this intense moment at the beginning about this. What is real? What is real? Is the world getting worse or is the world getting better? And at the end of that, I had the chance for a minute to share one reflection. And my reflection would be, we are actually living in a very different world than before. Right now, it looks the same as 2010, but it's very different, right? Like the world is so connected now with everything we do, with social media, but also all the logistics and everything, that whatever happens is happening very fast at a global level, and that we observe something I would describe as a rising awareness as the biggest trend in society. Like the awareness about things like global warming is like rapidly changing. The awareness about kind of like, for example, gay marriage. When I was in the US in 2008, Obama was running and he was making the statement, I believe marriage is the union between a man and a woman. That was 2008. And you basically had to say that in the US to get elected president in 2008. 2012, Joe Biden said a thing, he's on your side to the LGBT community. And that was basically perceived as a big problem because he might screw up and the Obama's chances to get elected again. In 2016, it was not possible as a Democrat to run on a platform to say that you are against gay marriage. And even now, basically, also the Republican side would not basically, at least most of them, not try to get kind of to that state again. So the whole world, not just the US, but also India, Ireland, Germany, everyone changed dramatically in not too many years. Then Greta Thunberg, everyone knew about global warming for 50 and more years, but she somehow changed the public perception of that topic as a symbol and grew collective awareness. Then you had George Floyd. It's not new that racism is there or police brutality, but that to see that video changed the world. So what I see happening is that the most powerful thing to change something these days is not even technology that takes a while. It is symbols. Powerful symbols have the ability to change the world overnight. It changed something like, Harvey Weinstein, for example. He was powerful, but then a day later he was not because, one report about him. My perception is that will go on faster and faster, that the rate of change will go on faster and faster, and that it's usually more awareness for more things that are bad. So therefore it feels so bad, right? Every year feels worse than the one before because we have more awareness of all the stuff that is screwed up. At the same point in time though, the world is getting better. So I think the both sides were right, right? They observe the same thing. We are aware of more stuff that is broken, and by getting this awareness, we also move them forward over time. So it's maybe like more like a Buddhist reflection. You have to first feel the pain of everyone and then to be enlightened and fix it. So that's it's kind of like my view also of media, that right now we get to the point where these symbols have the ability to change something. And that is maybe a good thing that we try to get the right symbols out there. There's all the other stuff, right? What about misuse of symbols? Right? You have also bad symbols that go out there. So it's not a one-way street. It's a powerful tool, though, and it will change society.
Thank you. Well, I think we're it's been a great pleasure to have you on the podcast. Kimon, I think we're more or less done, aren't we? There isn't anything else.
Yeah, I mean, Søren, thank you so much for your time. I thought your story, I feel like I really connected, and I've had a lot of very common things with you, and I really connected with, like, and just, and you're so interesting. I mean, like, the all the stuff that you've done. And then at the end, in the last 5 minutes, you chucked in the, you know, being a stay-at-home dad, taking over the, whatever, the head of the nursery school or whatever it was, the school board, and, you know, then traveling around the world with your pregnant wife for 6 months. I mean, crazy, crazy story.
I can recommend it, actually. I really, we have 4 kids now, and it's really, you can tell still this time I have with them. I can highly recommend to do something like that. Yeah. At least a few months or something. It is good stuff.
Yeah, anyway, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Go on, Richard. Thank you. Have a great day.